This episode of Continuing Mission is brought to you by the wonderful patrons of Trek FM who support us through Patreon. If you love Star Trek discussion, visit patreon.com/trekfm to find out how you can help and even become a part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm, and we thank everyone for their support.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Continuing Mission, our look at the ways in which fans are keeping Star Trek alive. I'm your host, Dennis Castello, and the primary focus of this show is on the fan series, or independent productions, that tell new stories set in the Star Trek universe. In this episode, I'm joined by writer and artist Guy Davis to discuss his fan project, the webcomic Tamerlane. If you like Star Trek stories, and you like the graphic novel medium, then you're in luck, because Guy Davis has been making Tamerlane stories since 2005, and that means that you'll have more than a decade's worth of Tamerlane stories to catch up on. But before we begin the interview, I wanted to quickly mention our Patreon campaign. Patreon is how we fund the Trek FM network. If you're not familiar with Patreon, I know I wasn't before I started listening to Trek FM, it's a great way to crowdfund ongoing projects. Avenues like Kickstarter or Indiegogo are great for one-time projects like a film, but Trek FM is putting out a Star Trek-related podcast nearly every day, all year round, and Patreon allows our supporters to pledge a little bit of money every month to help keep our shows coming. In my case, I live in Los Angeles, a city famous for its gridlock, and when I'm locked in bumper-to-bumper traffic on the 405, I feel like the Trek FM podcasts are the only thing keeping me sane. So I got to worrying. What am I going to do if Trek FM stops making podcasts? So that's when I decided to become a patron through Patreon and help out. Now, I'm a self-employed freelancer, which, as everyone knows, has its ups and downs. One day chicken, the next day feathers, as the saying goes. So one of the things I really appreciate about Patreon is that my contribution isn't set in stone. When I'm on a good job, I can give a little more. When I'm between gigs, I can go to patreon.com and adjust my contribution if I feel I need to. I'm never locked in, so I never have to worry. So if Trek FM has become part of your podcast listening routine, consider becoming a patron with Patreon and joining our team of supporters. We've got some great perks for you. Check them out at patreon.com/trekfm. Okay, with all that said, I guess it's time to take the turbo lift to the briefing room and begin our discussion with Guy Davis of Tamerlane. Welcome to Continuing Mission. I'm talking today with Guy Davis, the creator of Tamerlane. Welcome, Guy.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So, Guy, what is Tamerlane exactly?
Well, Tamerlane is a webcomic that I started in 2005. It's been a long time. And it follows the adventures of a TOS-era captain, Captain Julian Cochran, who's in charge of the USS Tamerlane, which is NCC 510. So it's been going on for a long time. There's some 200 and something pages of it now. But it's now a weekly webcomic, whereas before it was, I was putting it out per issue, so that, but there was year gaps in between, and I was losing followers every time.
Sure, that makes sense.
I started doing Tamerlane based on the principle of a friend of mine had, way back in 1987, when TNG came out, he had said, gosh, why is it always Enterprise? What happened to the rest of the Federation? There's got to be other ships out there. So the germ was sort of born there when I started the idea of there's got to be other ships that do other things. I mean, it can't just be the Enterprise flying around all the time. What if you followed the Hood? What if you followed, you know, somebody else?
Right.
And it always, back in the day, I also played a whole lot of Starfleet battles. And I,
oh yes,
yeah,
same here.
Yes, I love that game. And I noticed that a lot of people would go for the bigger, badder, nastier, more warp nacelles, more warp power, more phasers sort of concept. And so I thought, well, what if you didn't follow that at all? What if you followed one of the little guys that just did something, you know, kind of did the pickup work, you know, sort of was out there. And the seed sort of sat there for a while, obviously, for almost 20 years, because then in 05, I was talking to another friend, and we were talking about how Janeway seemed to, when they wrote Janeway in the beginning of Voyager, it seemed like they had to make her super butch. You know, they had to, she wasn't really that realistic. She seemed too mean. You know, it was almost like, oh, we're putting a woman in charge of the ship, so we've got to make her super mean so that everybody will respect her. And I thought, eh, you don't have to do that. So the captain, Julie Cochran, was born, who's pretty much an anti-Kirk. I made her to be exactly the opposite of Kirk. She's like a 4'9" Asian woman. You know, she can't fight her way out of a paper bag, but she's really sharp and really smart, and she's a little bit snarky. But that was sort of the genesis of Tamerlan.
Wow, I really love that idea, especially about the smaller ship. I've always thought that the smaller ships always have the more interesting roles. You look down through history, and of course, Hornblower, Horatio Hornblower, is an inspiration for Gene Roddenberry's writing of Star Trek. And you look at some of Hornblower's most exciting adventures, and they're all when he's in his smaller ships.
Yeah.
People don't kind of think of him until he gets into this big ship of the line. But most of his adventures take place in smaller ships, and they're doing all these interesting smaller roles. And I always thought that that's where the Star Trek should focus, is on the role of a smaller ship with a smaller crew, and have these adventures. It's less powerful, so the stakes are higher whenever they do get into fights.
Oh, absolutely.
I love your idea of the character of the captain, too. Somebody who's like smart and lives by her wits, that kind of thing. Why don't we go back, before we dive too far into Tamerlane, let's go back and tell me a little bit about yourself, where you're from, what your day job is, what was your first trek, that kind of thing.
Okay. I'm from Denver, Colorado, and have lived here pretty much all my life. I actually was born in Houston, but I only lived there for about a year and a half before my dad was transferred here. And I've been drawing forever. I knew I wanted to be an animator in high school. I actually drew animation cells in high school and tried to make my own film, which was only successful in that I actually made cells and learned how to do that. I went into art school after that and dropped out of art school and then went back to art school. And I have a degree in animation, a bachelor of science degree. And so I've been drawing comics for a very long time, but Star Trek has always been in my heart. I've been watching Star Trek since I was 3, I think. I don't remember a time when I wasn't a Star Trek fan. I really don't. In the 70s, we had one station here which had 3 call letters, one of those old 3 call letter stations, KOA. And I remember watching Star Trek at 4 in the afternoon on KOA. And I went back somewhere along the line and looked it up, and apparently that was the mid-70s, 75, 76, 77. But I remember that it was, you know, my mom and I on the couch, and we'd watch Star Trek. And then she would ask me questions about, you know, okay, so, you know, that guy had a half black, half white face, and the other one had a half white, half black face. What were they trying to talk about? And I'd be like, I'm not sure. But I remember talking about these things. And as I grew up, both my mom and dad are Trekkies. So as I grew up, we would discuss this. This would be, you know, the messages behind these episodes were important. So it's part of my my childhood, my entire life or whatever. I'm exactly like 2 days younger than Will Wheaton.
Oh, wow.
So when you see Wesley Crusher on the bridge, that's how old I was. So, because his birthday is July 29th in 1972 and mine's July 31st. Wow. So I was 14 when Next Gen came out, and I Boy, I didn't like that Wesley Crusher because I could have been on that bridge, man. Tell ya. But yeah, I'm a lifelong Trekkie.
So did you have a group of Trek friends who shared your fandom when you were younger, or were you kind of all alone out in your little community?
In the 70s and 80s, you know, being a geek wasn't really a very positive thing.
No, it wasn't.
So I had friends who were closet Trekkies. You know, we would talk about it, but we'd only talk about it when we were by ourselves because we didn't want to, you know, we didn't want our friends to get beat up or anything like that for being a Trekkie. So I had about three friends who were that way. But one of my friends was a rebel, so he didn't care. So he's the one that came up with the Star Trek, the rest of the Federation. He's more into cars than he is Star Trek, but he loved watching Star Trek while working on cars. So it worked.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a different world now. I mean, it's, you know, there are Trekkies out there everywhere, and it's really wonderful. We can kind of hang together, and once you say, you know, we're all Trekkies, everybody's like, oh, it's cool. You know, it doesn't matter where you're from or what your background is or anything like that. You just, oh, it's cool. You know, what's your favorite episode? You know, sort of thing.
Yeah, I can only imagine what those early conventions must have been like. You know, going and finding that community of Trek fans that you could finally, you know, you didn't have to, you could come out of the closet, so to speak. You didn't have to watch what you said and who was around, you know, like you would if you were if you wanted to talk Trek at high school or junior high or something. So, all right, so let's get to Tamerlan. And why don't you tell me when did you first get serious about you're going to actually, it went from the idea to actually making the comic. What caused that transition?
Well, I had been doing a number of short comics that have been published in little magazines all over the place. And it wasn't getting a lot of ground on that. I went back to school in 02 I was starting to work on an animation degree, and I had kind of caught on to the idea of a web comic, because before that I was really concentrating on getting published in magazines, putting out comics and things like that. And another dear friend of mine said, you know, they invented this thing called the internet. And I was like, oh yeah, that's true. And I hadn't even thought of that. It just never even occurred to me to publish something on the internet. So I went on ahead and bought usstamerlan.com as a domain. And what I did was I just took the Franz Joseph technical manual and picked a ship and stuff like that. And I said to myself, I said, you're going to stick to this. You've got stories to tell. You want to tell stories. And this is where you want to go with life. In order to do that, you have to stick to it. So I made By Her Reason Suede, which was the first episode of Tamerlan as a test. I was like, okay, if you can do this one, and stay with it and not drop it or get rid of it or, you know, hate it or whatever, and then we can move on. So I had made By Her Reason Suede, which is, by the way, a quote from Shakespeare, which is why it's spelled funny, because it's old English.
Sure.
But everybody thinks that I just suck at spelling. And so it's like, but anyway, it's supposed to be By His Reason Suede, which is a quote from Shakespeare, and I figured it was funny to make it her. Anyway, that worked, and I published it out on the Tamerlan website, and people had a response to it. There were people responding, and they liked the idea. They commented on the captain's wraparound short skirt, because that seemed to be a real focus. She's got the command green wraparound, but extended like a short skirt. And, you know, so it matches sort of the other short skirt uniforms that were worn by TOS crew members. And there was a lot of good positive response. So I started the Champion, and about a little way into the Champion, I was like, wow, this is really hard. So, but I had to stick to it. And so I worked real hard to kind of keep working on it and keep going. And it took 4 years to put out all of the Champion, because there's 200 or 180 pages in the Champion. It took a long time. It's all out on Tapastic now.
Mm-hmm.
So we can, if you want to read it, you can go read it on Tapastic.com. Because of course, Tamerlan has crashed like 12 times over the last, what has it been, 10 years, 11 years. So all of the episodes are no longer up there because in the last 11 years, it's cycled a couple of times. So Topastic's probably a little bit more solid to try to find it.
Well, that's great. Do you have any collaborators, anyone you work with, or is it really a one-man show for you?
It's really a one-man show, other than obviously I give lots of credit to my friends who've sort of angled me in the right direction. I've got these close friends who've asked me a number of these things. But I don't know. I mean, there's like I included the Saladin, which is another single engine destroyer fan film out there and things like that. I try to add in sort of the other fan films too, but yeah, it's just me.
So you're saying the Saladin is another fan project?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's Kenneth Thompson's fan project. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I met Kenneth Thompson working on one of the Star Trek Voyages shows. I volunteered on one. Mm-hmm. Met him. He's a great guy.
Yeah. Yeah. He let me borrow his characters and his ship and in the Champion. And I put that in there.
Oh, that's very cool. You're crossing over. You got fandoms crossing over, fan stories crossing over. That's awesome.
I like to do that because a lot of the fan stories would immediately put Kirk or Spock or McCoy in. And that gave back to that feeling of the Federation is just as big as the Enterprise.
Right,
there's
right.
only one ship, because everybody kept running into Enterprise characters. And there's only one canon character in all of Tamerlan, and it's a really obscure reference. So I will challenge people to find that someday. There's a very obscure reference to only one canon character in the entire run so far. I mean, I guess anything could change, but yeah, I started with using Farragut because I was working with John Broughton and his team doing Power Source and the Needs of the Many, which is their animated episodes. And they had brought me on to do that, and then they wanted me to continue on doing storyboards for the Farragut episodes. So because of that, I asked him if I could use Farragut for my first episode, and he was receptive to that. And so I try to make the crossovers to the fan films just to keep the feel that this is a big Federation with a lot of ships,
I think that's fantastic. Yeah. I think it helps bring the world of Tamerlane to life. I mean, it helps, as you said, it kind of reveals the shadowy corners. It sheds some light on those shadowy corners that, you might not otherwise know were there.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about your characters, your main characters in Tamerlane.
So initially when I started Tamerlane, the idea was to gender flip the entire thing. And as a very strange statement, gender flipping the TOS characters ended up with all women and one male communications officer. And it actually was kind of an awkward feeling. And I thought that's an interesting statement about our culture. But so I went for a 50-50 ratio, but the command, the big three Trinity right now is female. And you've got Commander Cochran, who's the captain. And then Angie Bennett is the first officer, and she's the weapons officer because, in the Tamerlane universe, the destroyers were more designed to be war machines. They were designed to be on the front line. They were designed to be police cruisers, that kind of thing. I liked the dichotomy between that and Gene Roddenberry's peaceful universe. It kind of makes it into a starship duncel. It doesn't do anything. It has no job. It serves no purpose sort of thing because there's no war. But Angie is the first officer, and she mans the weapons console, which is at the navigations station on a Constitution-class ship. And then the second officer is Brandi Ward, and she's the engineer. And she's the character that I brought in at the very beginning of The Champion to sort of be the entry point so that we can follow with her the story of Tamerlane. So you can look through her eyes in a way because she's not used to the destroyer fleet. She's not used to the different rules and it's all different than it is in a big ship. And so we kind of follow with her. She's also the stick in the mud. She's the serious character. Angie and Julie go back a long ways, and they're both, that's why Angie, even though she's the first officer, is very irreverent and probably not as military as she should be. And I've heard a lot of people say that Captain Cochran's a little loose and not very strict on her rules. That's her decision to run the ship that way. But Angie is also very in her face, which is very much anti-military as well. But they go back a long way. And there's a lot of allusion to the fact that they go back literally, a decade prior to them being on the ship together. So there's a lot there. And Cochran relies heavily on Bennett to keep her in line, even though at first, generally speaking, Cochran refuses to accept what Bennett has to say. A lot of it has to do with the fact that Bennett tends to come out with the first response, like any security officer, of shoot it. And Cochran's like, that's not our job. And so it takes a little while for Cochran to see where Bennett's coming from, and it's not necessarily always shoot it, but she just thinks that Bennett says that all the time. So that's sort of where we go. Down there from the line, there's, of course, the command staff continues down. We've got Dottrell, who was raised on Delta, so he's shaved, his head's shaved, and all of that stuff. So then we've got Robert Pacheco, who's the tactical officer who sits there. There's not a science station on a destroyer, just a tactical station. So where Spock's station would be is the tactical station. So he's got limited scanner ability. He can scan a little bit, but not really that much. I really enjoyed putting limitations on the ship. It can't do as much as the Enterprise, and it's important. It's a key part of the story.
Right.
So then we have a...
Good idea. Very good idea there.
It gives us something else to look into, and it limits the abilities of the crew to just be... I mean, they can't be saved by the Deus Ex Machina of a large ship. You know, they're stuck, you know. And so, and when the Tamerlan approaches the Orion slaver in the first issue, he can't see through all of the plasma, but they can beam through it, which means that clearly the sensors are, for the Enterprise, that's reversed. You know, the sensors could see far more than where they could transport. But with the Tamerlan, they just can't see anything. They might as well look out a window, you know. So that's sort of where we go. And then we've got a spattering of other characters that I'll bring on that are in there. I'm particularly fond of the CSI tech that's on board, because the mission role that I had kind of given the Tamerlan now was more like a police ship. So,
interesting.
So there's a CSI tech whose job it is to kind of do that kind of research. There's a CSI team on board. So when they come across a crime scene or something like that, they can go down there and analyze it and everything like that. And that gave kind of a different twist to what this ship does. But I like her because she's got a very thick Puerto Rican accent. And it's so much fun to... I can hear her clearly in my head speaking in this Puerto Rican accent. And then I have to write it out with disses and all of this, like, really weird... It's hard to, like, literally translate what she's saying. But I was really impressed by a lot of comics. And, excuse me. Sometimes there were comics and novels that would portray Scotty's accent in a literal sense. They would literally try to transliterate his brogue. And I loved that. And so with Viejo, I'm trying to translate her Puerto Rican accent really literally. Because she's kind of dark and she's got kind of a quirky personality anyway. But I thought she was kind of fun to have this Puerto Rican brogue going, or Puerto Rican, I guess it's not a brogue, but this Puerto Rican accent to her.
Nice. That's very cool.
Thank you.
I know you talked about where you got the idea, or where the idea for the Tamerlan came from, but what's inspired the plots of the story? You've done one kind of long, extensive one that's the Champion. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So what inspired the plot of that particular story?
So I kind of call myself a storyteller. That's sort of what I want to do with my life. And... really what happens is that I I ask myself these moral quandaries every so often. You know, what if you had a situation where you had the Doomsday Machine from the Doomsday Machine, but the Doomsday Machine was guilty and felt like it needed to be euthanized for its behavior, or at least justice brought to it. But you couldn't attack it. It would destroy you if you tried that. And then, is that an appropriate thing for a Federation ship to do? You know, to go out and destroy? You know, it's in the Champion, that's the question that Cochrane asks, is, you know, our mission statement is to seek out new life and new civilizations, not seek out new life and destroy it. That's not our job. So that quandary really fascinated me and resonated with me. And so when I wrote The Champion, I'm exploring that one. With the new one, The Lark and the Nightingale, I have something similar. I have a similar question that I'm asking. Although we haven't gotten to it yet, I've noticed. I'm still kind of wading through backstory. But that's all right. There was a question that was asked by my wife, and she was like, Cochrane was married. What happened to her husband? I said, well, let's find out. So we're sort of exploring that aspect first, but there's a similar question there. I always wonder what would happen. I mean, what are the ethics of the holodeck? You know, if you're, you know, we asked this question with Moriarty in Next Gen, but you still sort of have that question of what are the ethics of turning off something, a life form? You have a life form. You parked him in stasis in memory. You know, I always ask these quandaries. So these questions come up, and sometimes I feel like that Star Trek answers them adequately, and then sometimes I feel like, but wait, there was more. Right, I had another question. Yeah. I want to ask one more question. So,
and sometimes the answer to one question leads to a bunch of other questions.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's, so a lot of these stories come from that, and I'm exploring all of them. Although I'm going to probably be taking a twist with the story at some point here, where they'll all end up being flashback stories. But there are a lot of questions that I want to know about Star Trek specifically that I'm asking with Tamerlan. And that's where they kind of come from, is that, but wait, I want to know this one thing. You didn't tell me this one thing. You know, you didn't answer this one question. So that's where they come from mostly.
Okay.
For Tamerlan anyway, yeah.
So what's your favorite part of creating Tamerlan?
I love hearing the characters talking in my head, especially Bennett. She's got this really weird irreverence that is just kind of fun. And when the two characters, when I'm writing a scene and Cochrane and Bennett are arguing over something, just the biting commentary that sometimes Bennett will take these pot shots at Cochrane, and it's like, I've had friends like that, you know, who just, they know what they're saying and they know what they're after, and they're just taking pot shots at you. But I love the writing is both the hardest and the part that I love the most. I love drawing it, obviously. It's a lot of fun to draw it. The building the 3D models isn't that much fun, because I do the sets and the backgrounds, and I do the starships now in 3D models because I can't draw a circle. So, and since, you know, a starship is pretty much a circle, not being able to draw a circle is sort of a handicap. So anyway, so that's, I think, really writing the character interactions is my favorite part. I probably shouldn't, like, hang out there, though.
Okay, so what have you learned that you didn't know before you started?
I think the biggest thing that I didn't know, because I've been drawing for a long time before I started doing the comic. Obviously, hey, look, there's an internet out there, which is an amazing thing to learn 15 years after they invent it. That's not true. I was on the internet before. I just didn't think about this as a webcomic. I think the biggest thing I learned is how broad the fan community is, and how how wide it is and how many people are in it and all these people who will do all kinds of amazing things, like build exact duplicates of the Stage 9 sets. And I mean, just, and not just one, but three of them, you know, I mean, it's just astonishing to me, and they're accurate. And
you're referring to the Desilu Stage 9 sets, the original series.
Right. That's right. I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm talking about, you know, the Ticonderoga group, which is doing phase two, and the Star Trek Continues Farragut group, which is, you know, has one set out in Georgia. And then there's another one in Oklahoma City now, Starbase Studios,
right,
who are, you know, and I'm just astonished that out there, there's not one, but three duplicates down to the blueprints, you know,
right,
of the 1960s set. And they paid for it out of their own pockets. I mean, you know, I mean, I thought when I first started this, I thought, nobody's going to be that interested in a Star Trek comic. I mean, people don't. Does anybody even like Star Trek anymore? Enterprise was kind of winding down, and we were kind of coming to an end. And, you know, of course, there was that long discussion from Berman saying nobody likes Star Trek anymore. And so I was like, oh, man, does anybody even like it anymore? And I think that was the thing that shocked me the most was, yeah, there are people out there who are willing to drop $20,000, $30,000 to do this, you know?
Right, yeah. Clearly, though, the fan productions are evidence that there's a large number of people out there who want more Star Trek.
Absolutely.
And they want the Star Trek that appeals to them. I think that's where you see why all these people are kind of behind Axanar, and why all these people love Star Trek Continues and Star Trek New Voyages is,
mm-hmm,
they want the kind of Trek that really appeals to them as fans of the original series and some of the better movies and things like that.
Oh yeah.
So, but
I totally agree.
There's plenty of new fans coming on board with the new movies. And so, mm-hmm, we're going to see probably even more fan films and fan projects based on the new stuff.
Oh yeah. And I'm really gratified to see Nick Meyer coming on board with the new TV series and Brian Fuller. And I think that there's going to, I don't envy them. I really don't. I mean, you watch the original series, I grew up on it. It's like going home. But sometimes when you go home, you realize that your grandmother wears, you know, 1950s horn-rimmed glasses and stuff like that. And you realize that when you go home, you're the one that looks at her and goes, yay, she's wonderful. But everybody else looks at her and goes, wow, kind of outdated. And watching the old Star Trek is like that. And I get that. And I understand that. And I know that we'll never go back to Kirk, Spock, and McCoy the way they were. So I understand they want to make it faster and things like that. And I get that. And I appreciate that too. So it's a fine line that Fuller is walking. And I don't envy him. I mean, I really don't. How do you boil down the essence of what Gene Roddenberry was trying to say when he was doing the series and make it in a much faster paced, much more shooty, blowy, uppy world and make that work? So I don't envy him. I really don't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's tough. When I think of these things, when I think of stories, I try to think of, you know, trying to do this the way that Roddenberry did things. He was a big fan of Jonathan Swift. That's very evident. And, you know, when you know the history of Gulliver's Travels, you can kind of see what he was after, because, you know, Gulliver's Travels was really a commentary about the church. But back then you'd get killed for that.
Right.
So Jonathan Swift couldn't just say the church sucks. He had to write this whole story about Lilliputians, and that was what inspired Roddenberry to write. So in a lot of ways, I try to see how to embed that into Tamerlan, and it's hard. It's really, really hard. So how do you do it now with Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto? And, you know, how do you get that embedded in there too, so you can still follow that Jonathan Swift-esque world without becoming preachy and talky and just standing there and being talking heads, it's really hard. So I don't envy them.
Do you feel any pressure when you're writing and drawing Tamerlane? Do you feel pressure to be more exciting or have more action? Or I know you're obviously in a very different medium than a feature film or a TV show. But do you feel any pressure to kind of like be less intellectual and more exciting?
You know, not yet. I have like, you know, 7 followers and a cat. So I'm really, it's not like the feedback that I get, generally speaking, is, I believe firmly in Shakespeare once said, to thine own self be true. I feel like when artists stop being true to themselves, that's when their stories jump the shark. Mm-hmm. And so I try very hard to stay true to my feelings on this one and listen to people as much as I can. But if you listen to everybody, you go every direction and then you lose sight of where you are in your story. And so I'm worried about that. I so far the biggest complaint was, but I thought you said that you were going one direction and you went a different direction with your story. And I was like, oh no. And I obsessed over that for like 4 years. So it was like, but I mean, that's been like the biggest critique that I've gotten so far. Which is, I guess, okay. I mean, I had a weird communication with someone once about using a trope that was misogynistic. And I thought that was a very interesting thing, since clearly misogyny is, you know, anti-misogyny is sort of a point of my comic. So I thought that was kind of a strange thing. But for the most part, I don't hear much negative about my story yet. I'm sure it's bound to come around the corner. It's just a matter of time. For me, I think I'm just going to keep it the way it is. I use the old series as my template. I've been running off of the old series uniforms and the old series ships and stuff like that, and kind of holding there so I can kind of keep the old series pacing and that fits the genre.
Sure.
So I feel like that it's appropriate. I don't know if I want to go faster anyway. I think that kind of goes against the theme, which is the Tamerlane is bristling with weapons that it never uses, you know?
Right, right.
So it's like, you know, they're always ready to use them and then they never do. And they're always ready to use them and they never do.
So what's been your single greatest challenge making this project?
Sticking to it. That's my biggest boogeyman. It always is. And it's evident. There comes these, like, that's one of the, I use Tamerlane as sort of a bed for self-improvement as well as a storytelling medium. And that's why we get different formats and different ways of doing things. And I experiment with it. And The Last Night of the Year is like a storybook, even though it's not, you know, so it's, you know, it's like all of these are in different formats. The Lark and the Nightingale's in this like Sunday comic strip format. But the real challenge for me has always been to stay with it. I'm very proud of the fact that I've been with this project for 11 years now. That's an amazing accomplishment for me. I didn't have quite that track record before. So I think that's the biggest problem, is staying to it, getting these things out every night or every Saturday night at midnight. And one of the goals of my Patreon is if we hit a certain amount, I'll be putting out 2 of these a week. So I've managed to sort of lock myself into a corner so that, you know, if we get enough interest in it and there's enough people who are patrons and things like that, I'll be forced to do this twice. So there you go. If you want to torture an artist, become a patron.
Yes, and then demand output on a schedule.
Right.
Yeah.
Unscheduled output, yes. Yeah.
Be brilliant on a schedule. Yeah.
Right.
So
it's hard to do art on demand.
Yes, indeed. It's hard to be brilliant on demand in any fashion. Yeah.
any field, yeah. Yes.
So what's been your single greatest joy in making the project?
Looking at a completed version of these, because I'd print them all out to, at the end, whenever I was, back in the days when I was doing the individual episodes, issues, I would do a new issue and I would print them out and then staple them together, and it would have weight and it would land on the table with a thump. And I was like, wow, all of that, I did this, you know, and that was the biggest joy for me because, like I said, my biggest boogeyman is not finishing things and not completing things. So that has been the biggest joy for me. And I know that that's a very personal joy, and it's, you know, there was that. Another thing was one point in time, I belonged to like the Starfleet Battles groups on Facebook, and somebody I had never met, I never knew him, I whatever, posted a picture from Tamerlan because my slaver is based off of their Orion slavers from Starfleet Battles, because we'd never seen an Orion ship. So I just sort of assumed Orion's kind of look like that. So, but he was saying, hey, look, somebody wrote this really good comic, and here's an Orion slaver in it, and clearly it's inspired by Starfleet Battles. And I was like, wow, all of the things that I intended to do with that, he recognized. And I'm some nobody. Nobody knows me, but this guy found my comic. And I thought that was just so cool. I was like, that was, shocking. I mean, it's not like it was an ego boost necessarily, so much as a, oh no, people are reading my comic, so if I'm stupid, they're going to read it. So, but it was, at the same time, it was really exciting. It was cool. It was like, wow, there's people reading my comic. And, oh no, there's people reading my comic. Yeah.
It's gratifying, but also at the same time, a little terrifying.
Exactly. Exactly. But it, in the end, that's why I'm starting to kind of put myself out there. I had to make a decision at that point. I was like, okay, are you going to be serious about this? Because if you are, we need to be serious. And so let's get out there. Let's start promoting it. Let's start getting it out every week. Let's do all the things that need to be done. So that's sort of where I went from there.
So what are your goals for future projects, for your current project and for perhaps future projects?
So my big dream in life is to make an animation studio that does the old 2D style animation with, you know, 3D assist, but not the Pixar style 3D, but rather backgrounds and things like that in 3D, but with a hand-drawn 2D foregrounds and characters. I feel like that's an art style that should be held on to. So that's my dream. And there's a number of projects that are in the works. We're doing a project called Star Trek Windjammer now, which is another, it's an animated series. It's going to be in the style of Filmation's animated series. And I'm the lead animator on that. And I want to evolve everything into this. I want to evolve Tamerlan as well. It's going to be changing up at some point here, so that it's less heavy on the IP, and more, I can't sell any Tamerlan right now. I mean, it's Star Trek, so I can't sell it. And so I think one of the evolutions I want to try to do is figure out a way so that I can keep working with Cochrane and Bennett and Ward and evolve it out so that I can find a way to sell stories in some way or another that involves those characters. So that's my future plan on that.
All right. Great. So, I know probably many of the, listeners to a podcast like Continuing Mission are fans that might be thinking about doing their own fan projects. So if there's someone out there who's thinking about doing a web comic or a graphic novel or an animated kind of Star Trek fan project, what advice would you have for those fans?
Well, I think the biggest advice is be consistent. Don't let the old artist boogeyman get to you, the one that says your art's not good enough. Just put it out there and you will grow in time. And people will follow you and it will be fine. And somehow you have to just kind of come to that realization that this isn't perfect, but it's going out because it's Saturday night and this has to be up by midnight. And that's the way it goes. Don't let the boogeyman get you. And I think that's probably the only advice that I can think of. If you're going to do a webcomic or anything for that matter, You know, don't let the boogeyman get to you. Do your art and do it from your heart. Which rhymed.
That's fantastic advice. Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
So tell us where our listeners can find you, your website, your Tapastic site, and tell us about your Patreon.
Okay. Well, you can find all of Tamerlan. Well, you can find all of Tamerlan on Tapastic/Tamerlan. Tapastic is a comic genre place where there's all kinds of great things on there, and you know, my comic is also there. And you can find the website is at usstamerlan.com. And that's been there for a long, long time. You can also find me on Facebook at USS Tamerlan. And my Patreon is patreon.com/GSDavisArt. So that's G as in Guy and S as in Steven, which is my middle name, Davis. Because there's already a Guy Davis comic artist out there, and I didn't want to confuse myself with him. So GS Davis Art. If you're a patron, you can get the episodes a little earlier. And so that's always a big perk for being a $3 or more patron and trying to kind of get a little earlier. And I'm working on that. And I also do live draws for patrons that are $10 or more every month. So except to this month because it's Super Tuesday and I have to go vote. So it's the first Tuesday of every month is when I do my live draws. So and I'll sit there and I'll do a Google Hangout. And if you're a $10 or more patron, I'll let you join me and you can talk to me and we can draw things and it'd be fun. So.
Well, that's fantastic. Guy, thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a lot of fun talking to you about Tamerlan.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to another 10 years of Tamerlan stories from Guy Davis. If you want to catch up on Tamerlan, the best way to do that is to use the Tapastic app for Android and iOS. Or just go to their website at tapastic.com. That's T-A-P-A-S-T-I-C. And search for Tamerlan. As you know by now, we have over 20 different podcasts on the Trek FM network, and they aren't all talking about Star Trek webcomics, so here's a sample of some of our other shows on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
You've heard Chief Trip sign on. I'm serious, Ken. Actually, out of the chair, please.
Okay. God.
I guess the Commodore has the con!
Earl Grey.
Did you really write down Groppler Zorn on this list?
I was just kidding. What fruit did he like before he got to apples?
The Ready Room.
I think all of us Star Trek fans at one point or another probably retreat into this universe we love, Star Trek, that is, it's a fictional world.
What are you talking about, Zachary? Are you suggesting that like fans might decide to buy microphones and like talk about it like it's real for hours on end?
Commentary, Trek stars.
In the first movie, it was really like, you know, let's go race some cars, you know?
Yeah.
And then let's go steal some TV VCR combos.
Yeah. Is that really what it is?
Yes, that's what they were stealing.
That's awesome.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm. You'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. Those perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or if you have a fan project that you would like to discuss with us, you can contact us in several different ways. You can use the form at trekfm/contact. You can also leave us a voicemail. Look in the sidebar on the Continuing Mission show page at Trek FM or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. Our Twitter handle is at Trek FM. We can be found on Facebook at Trek FM. Or you can join the discussion on Trek FM's listeners-only group on Facebook called The Babel Conference. Type The Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or go to our website at Trek FM and click Discussion on the menu bar. The Babel Conference is a closed group, but if you ask to join, we'll let you right in and you can join the discussion. We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of Continuing Mission on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. I can always be found on the Babel Conference on Facebook, and my Twitter handle is at Dennis Castello. We'd like to acknowledge the rest of the Trek FM team, without which this or any of our podcasts would not be possible. C. Brian Jones, our founder and publisher of Trek FM, executive producers Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, the Trek FM's art director, Will Wynn, our content manager, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. Thanks for joining us, and see you on the next mission.